The Urbanist is brought to you in association with the Department of Culture and Tourism, Abu Dhabi. Saadiyat Cultural District, Abu Dhabi, is a beacon of hope and inspiration. A catalyst to spark growth and collaboration with museums and experiences, where art and science and nature and technology coexist.
The belief of Abu Dhabi that culture is the backbone of our society.
Stay tuned for a special episode of the show, in which you can hear His Excellency Mohammed Khalifa Al Mubarak explain exactly why and how Saadiyat Cultural District Abu Dhabi is the perfect place to collaborate, create and innovate. Saadiyat Cultural District Abu Dhabi, proud partner of The Urbanist on Monocle Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Urbanist, Monocle's programme all about the built environment. I'm your host, Andrew Tuck. Coming up...
That's the problem, I think, is this huge war between form and content, the individual and society, personal brand, as opposed to responsibility and reputation that a personal brand builds.
As another edition of Monocle's event series, The Chiefs, wrapped up last week, this year coming to you from Hong Kong, we look back at some of the highlights from a day jam-packed with world-leading insight. From an architect focusing on the small scale, to an expert getting people from A to B, plus a look at a Japanese hospitality venture that is revitalising its community. That's ahead over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. First up, we're going to hear from Kevin Mark Lowe, an educator and founder of Small Projects. He had the audience gripped with his take on architecture, from how most architects only ever make one great building to how to be a good client. In this clip, Mark starts by explaining why he thinks that the word style is the least important in the world of architecture.
There are some words in the architecture, in the whole world, but in the architectural especially, that have been undefined for like decades. And one of those words is design, another is the word style. We use them interchangeably. And architects constantly refer to what is actually an act of styling, which has to do with form, as design. That's not design. You don't call someone a hair designer. They're a hairstylist. They don't care whether the hair looks good after 3 days. They don't care if it's easier to wash or easier to dry. It just looks, makes you look good, you know? If your eyes are far apart, then the hair is pulled closer to your, you know? If your eyes are really close, you know, if it's thin, they may have to make it boofy. And unfortunately, architects, we focus on aesthetics. And that's about form. It's styling. And then we're inspired by a biomimicry. Okay, this one resembles. Even great architects like Eero Saarinen, you know, the TWA terminal, he was inspired by flight. Look, an airport's not about flight. That's what planes do. An airport's about walking interminable distances. And how many airports in the world are designed around walking? Walking really quick because you're late. Walking after you've taken a nap and, shit, I'm going to miss my flight, right? So we've not really thought about the critical content of what we design. We don't think about what a house is. What is dwelling? What is a school? Is a school a place where you go to learn different things, or it's a place where you go to learn how to become a different person? Now, the way you frame a question changes how you process what comes after. And I think design is misunderstood because it's about questions, not about answers. Styling is about answers. Styling is about finding a solution, and designing is about not just finding a solution, but beginning with understanding a question or asking a question that's never been asked before.
Kevin, we're going to be nice, but not, don't put anybody in the bad list, but who's the best architect apart from yourself? Who's who do you look around the world and see making stuff that you like? We know it's not going to be somebody who's style over everything else, but who do you look at and think, okay, I like their work?
There's no such thing as the best architect in the world. We're all human, and if we're God, we'll design like multiple great buildings, but we can't. And any great architect is good for just one great building in a lifetime. And I search out those buildings.
Okay, have you built yours?
No, I don't think I ever will. I'm not a great architect. I think I'm a good teacher, but I don't think I'm a great architect.
Okay, so give me...
doesn't mean I stop hoping.
Give us one building that if we went to see it with you, you could say, this is a masterpiece.
I can tell you one building designed by the world's most famous mediocre architect, but it's the one of the greatest buildings of the 21st century. It's the Louvre Museum edition in Paris. Ian Pei is a completely mediocre architect. You can see it by studying and analyzing his buildings. But that building in Paris, it took him 3.5 months to decide that he would do it because he didn't feel capable. And he told Mitterrand, look, let me live in Paris. Let me understand what's... And that building is a stroke of genius because what do you put in the middle of a French Baroque courtyard with French Baroque buildings all around it? And that pyramid is a stroke of brilliance because he didn't appeal to French Baroque architecture for his inspiration. He looked at French Baroque landscape architecture and planning and French Baroque painting. And I wish I could give you a lecture on that because it's such a great understanding of what makes that building great. You know, the Parisians hated everything about that building from the moment it was proposed till the day it was built. The day it opened, everyone in university loved it. And they didn't know why. And then when I sent a lecture in Paris, it was one of my proudest moments. She came up to me and said, you know, I never understood why I liked that building, and now I do. And I felt so happy because you don't have to be inspired by architecture to produce great architecture because it's not about form. And the Louvre Museum, it's not a building. It's a portal to an underground Baroque cavern. Horribly detailed. Don't get me wrong. I mean, Ian Pei is not a genius with detail, but that building conceptually, it's unbelievable. And the ceiling of it, it's a glass pyramid. And the pyramid comes from the country that France has most pillaged from. never mind the fact that it's the easiest way to cover a hole in the ground, a portal to an underground cavern. And the detail of that, look, the part of the Baroque was all about trompe l'oeil, which is this amazing ceiling paintings to dematerialize. I mean, the Catholic Church was completely corrupt, right? And the Baroque architecture resulted as a way of hiding the materiality of things so that you could still appeal to God is still great, the Pope, yeah, you know? And so trompe l'oeil, but look, it's transparent with the same grid work you see in the Sistine Chapel. And what do you see? The ceiling of the French Baroque buildings outside.
You've spoken about the woman who came up to you after your lecture, and I can see why lots of people would. You're an inspiring teacher. What should our, we're not trained like you, but what should our response be to good architecture? Well, how do we know that we're seeing something? Is it because it makes us, it moves us, it trips us up, it's got something inspiring about it? Well, how do you know that you're in the company of good architecture?
I think a good artwork is something that pulls from its context and amplifies its context more than it amplifies itself. Like, I think of it in terms of human relationships. If you've got a group of people, 5 people there, you don't walk right in them and having a conversation. You don't walk right in the middle of them and just start spouting whatever's on your mind. No, you stand quietly and respectfully on the side, listen to what they're talking about, and maybe if there's something to offer, you pitch in, right? But that's not how architects behave. We just want to be right in the middle. We want to be the center of attention. We want to build our phallic symbols. We want to do everything that draws attention to ourselves because it's our reputation that's more important than our responsibility. And that's the problem, I think. It's this huge war between form and content, the individual and society, personal brand, as opposed to responsibility and reputation that a personal brand builds.
I think there are some other words these days that get batted around. I'm not sure they all mean a great deal. Legacy, but maybe responsibility is a pretty good word to think about. When these people think about commissioning a building, starting a project, making a home, what words do you think that they should have in their mind before they pick up the phone to an architect, to somebody who's going to help them navigate that journey? What's the words you hope they have in their mind?
Make a living, not a killing, if you're a developer, you know? And we're too used to acquiring, and this world is so based on acquisition, we forgot that we can't have a global economics based on acquisition. It's got to be about distribution. And we don't have that in tow. We've got so many millions and billions. I mean, I spend all my money. You're only rich if you spend your money, you know? Because you don't know when you're going to fall down with a stroke or die. Even as a young person, your car could hit you tomorrow. You stand a better chance of dying from a car crash from flying or taking a flight. And I think if you really care about what you do, spend your money. Don't save it. Your kids can make their own bloody money. And it doesn't mean that you don't have something in the safe, but that it's time we stop acquiring to a point where we don't even know what to do with it. It's crazy. We got, over the last 60 to 100 years, we've found everything we've ever wanted. We don't really ask questions about what we really need. And I think that's the problem with this responsibility, reputation.
Kevin Mark Lowe there, speaking with me on stage at the Chiefs. Next, we're going to hear from Noni Purnomo, chairperson of Indonesia-based Bluebird Group Holding, who happened to be one of the world's biggest taxi operators, navigating in one of the world's toughest areas when it comes to traffic. We're going to pick up the conversation with Noni, answering how she even begins to operate in a city like Jakarta, which has such huge traffic issues.
Praying? I think that's the first thing. But it is true that the biggest challenge for us, especially because we own and operate our own vehicles, efficiency and productivity is extremely important for us. So the traffic congestion in Jakarta really is a big issue. We're actually very grateful with the latest technology, because with the latest technology, we'd be able to guide or navigate through the traffic as efficient as possible, and we'll be able to guide our drivers to go through the most efficient route and pick up services. So that way we can manage to make our operational more efficient by using the technology. But it is still a challenge. That's why we're trying to shift our gear toward more renewable energy, because we hope that operational-wise is cheaper. Also because gasoline consists of about 23% of our revenue. It's pretty high. And the maintenance, because we do our own maintenance, so we have our depots, so every night, every single vehicle that we have come back to our depot, so we have to clean it, we have to maintain it. And so we do have maintenance services in each depot. And maintenance is about 9% of our revenue. So that's also one of the reasons why we're looking into different type of vehicles with less maintenance, hence the launching of the electric taxi.
And I believe there's been a bit of a tussle with people lobbying you to be the provider of choice for Bluebird with the electric vehicles.
Yeah, well, when the president announced the aspiration for Indonesia to have a net zero target by 2060, so we took that opportunity in our little ways. How could we, as a small company in Indonesia or part of a company in Indonesia, that we can contribute to this aspiration? So in 2019, we launched our electric taxi. At this moment, we still have less than 200 or just about 200. So there's a lot of challenges in implementing electric vehicle in Indonesia, especially at that time. It took us 2 years to just get the proper licenses and, you know, to navigate through the unripe rules, and, you know, if I may say so. But that's the beauty of it, I think. You know, this is another thing that my late grandmother was telling me, that as long as there's still chaos or grays, then you got a lot of opportunities. You know, when everything settled down, then, you know, you're flat, basically. So we always like to see this different opportunities with all its challenges. And Indonesia is still growing. I mean, we're still growing very rapidly. And with that, I mean, of course, we can't expect everything to be certain yet, right? Which I normally called as 100 shades of grace. So we still have the 100 shades of grace, which we should navigate. And as I said, grace comes opportunity.
Well, I want to come into some of the ways in which you run your company, but just you threw us a few of the kind of hurdles you faced. The likes of Uber come along, these apps, then you have a pandemic. Believe me, we know a magazine that sold in train stations and airports what the pandemic was like, but you're a taxi company, and when people were told to stay at home, how the hell did you get through that?
Yeah, imagine. I'm a third generation. So when I took over from my father, and you know what they say about third generation. So first generation founded the company, second generation built the company, and the third generation, well, hopefully I've proven it, does not ruin the company. So so I took over from my father, and then we got hit by ride hailing, and then we got hit by pandemic. So yeah, how did I wake up every morning and still wanted to go to the office? I think what is very much, I'm very privileged because I get a very strong company from my father, who had built the company together with my late grandmother, with very good values. We always focus on integrity and we really practice this every single day. I think we are the company, if I can claim, that return lost belongings the most, I would say, not just in Indonesia, but I'm sure in any other countries as well. We return about 77% of our left belongings in our taxis. The reason for the 23% is because a lot of our customers left the country after, because we have a lot of, you know, tourists coming.
They're not fleeing. They're going back on their holidays. We made that clear.
Yeah, that's true. But integrity, I think, is very important to us. And we're basing it in every day in our life, and also care for others. And this is one of the things that my late grandmother always reminded me when she was still alive, that we always have to treat every single person in our company as if they're our own family members. And this is how we get over those challenges. The ride hailing, for example, it was the worst time, because I remember in March 2016, there was a huge demonstration in Jakarta, and everyone suddenly pointed at Bluebird that we were actually behind the demonstration. There were like 2,000 people out there on the street, and they were public transport drivers. So they pointed at Bluebird, and of course it was devastating for us, because Bluebird was known before then as the bird of happiness, and suddenly in social media it came out this red angry bird, you know, so it's like, oh my goodness. So it's actually devastating for us, but most devastating for our drivers. Can you imagine every single day they ran out on the street thinking that, okay, they're going to give all their heart, all their time, and all their efforts to give the best possible transportation services to the passengers, and suddenly in one day they were doomed? So I think the first thing, as a leader, we need to go to them and try to put their energy back up. So at that time, on that day, so the demonstration was done around 9 a.m. in the morning. So at 11 a.m., we had this media talk, and we said, we announced that the next day, we're going to give free taxi ride for everyone for 24 hours. And a lot of people thought at that time that it was just a PR gimmick. But actually, what we wanted to achieve was to lift the morale of the drivers, because they were so down on that day. So the next morning, they have to be able to come back to work with really a big heart, knowing that, oh, they're going to give something to everyone. So this is the thing that we do, so that I think that is the main reason why we survive all
the... Noni, we have the shirt up here, but perhaps this is a good point to bring the shirt in, because this is important. You spoke to me, you said, it should be a thing of pride for a driver to wear this. Yes. You've got one yourself.
Yes.
The greatest thing was when we did the call before we met, I called Noni on the video call, and she's got it set up so that she's sitting in an imaginary taxi when you do the call. So she was like, wing mirrors there and everything. It was very good. But tell us about why this should make a person who gets in your car as a driver feel, I'm a Bluebird driver.
Yeah, so this is a batik, if all of you know about the Indonesian traditional fabric. And we would like to represent that, because we're 100% Indonesian. We were born in Indonesia, I mean, as a company as well. And then this is full with philosophy. So this would be given to our drivers when they become our permanent drivers. So when we recruit the drivers, they have to be a temporary driver or a trainee for about 6 months, in order for them to become our permanent drivers. And during that time, of course, they're being trained, they're being monitored, and when they become our permanent driver, then they will be given this as a symbol. And of course, this one, as I mentioned, filled with philosophy, because my late grandmother is Japanese and my grandfather too, so we always have this kind of philosophy. So these are the birds as the fundamental base of the uniform itself, so the little birds with the values of the bluebird itself, with the bird of happiness that would just carry everything else above. This is the rice. Rice symbolizes prosperity, so we hope that the bird will grow or give prosperity, as in our vision, prosperity for our stakeholders. And this flower symbolizes that we should spread the prosperity around, so it's not just for the shareholder, not just for the Bluebird family members, but also for the whole society, in particular Indonesian society.
Now, Noni, you run a fund as well, and the fund does lots of good things, but one of the great things it does, because of your grandmother, because of you, helps women who want to be in business, and you do a lot through scholarships for your drivers to help their sons and especially their daughters. Just tell us a little bit about being a woman leader in business, in logistics, in any country is tough, in Indonesia, and what you're trying to do for young women who want to get into business.
Yeah, thank you. I'm actually, most of the time, I'm a minority, because not just in the industry, a female is still a minority, but also in my family. In my generation, there are 7 of us, and only 2 females, and I'm not even the oldest. So you could imagine the way we were brought up. So we were given equal opportunity, but we are always reminded that equal opportunity comes with equal responsibility. So you can't just expect you get your rights without giving back. I think that's how we are being trained, per se. So because of that opportunity that I receive, I try to expand that to the Bluebird family. So in 1999, we launched a scholarship program for the children of our drivers. And during that time, there were less than 10% of, I would say, maybe 2% of girls, so the female scholarship recipients. But currently, we're giving about 1,600, 1,700 scholarships every semester. And currently, 52% are girls or females. So I think we have achieved quite a lot in there, not just by the numbers, but what is most important is that means our drivers, our employees, they understand the importance of giving equal opportunity to both girls and boys. And I think that's the biggest achievement of the program. And then from there, we got hit by recession. But then because we have limited funding, so we can only afford to give scholarships to high school and university students. But I realize most of the children of our drivers are really only in elementary or junior high schools. So we try to find a way on how can we expand this. So then we try to encourage the wives of our drivers and also the adult daughters of our drivers to start businesses from their home. So that's when we launched Kartini Bluebird program. We give vocational training for the female members, whether they're the daughters or the wives of our drivers. We give them vocational training in several ways so that they can open businesses from home. They don't have to give anything back to Bluebird. The only thing I ask from them is to give equal opportunity to boys and girls and to make sure that the girls would go to school as well. So I think that's the purpose of the program.
My thanks to Noni Purnoma there. Finally today, to hospitality and the sector's effect on the built environment. Yuta Oka is the founder and CEO of Staple and co-founder of Naru Developments, who's been doing work on Ikuchijima, a tiny island in Japan's Seto Island Sea. He has revived a series of buildings, creating 3 inns along the way, and this diligent work has meant that an outpost with an ageing population has suddenly seen an uptick in young people moving to the island. Oka joined Monocle's Fiona Wilson to discuss his work, and he began by explaining how the project began.
We encountered the site, the island, and it was a beautiful place, as you can see, but we only spotted maybe like 2 or 3 people in the town. It's like everything was alongside the Shotengai, which is the kind of the main retail corridor of the town. Everything was shut, 2 or 3 people. We thought it was just going to die. But it was still, you know, you felt like there was still low but certain energy coming. And we were always looking for somewhere. Going back to my previous career, I had the luxury to work with a few luxury hotel brands, not large scale, but small scale, very culturally sensitive and sensible brands that kind of lift up the local community and the culture and the arts and food and everything. And the highest impact that had in my life was my stay at Amandari, which was also a creation of Adrian Zecca, who's my current business partner. for Azumi. And when I stayed there, a gentleman got me at the airport. We rode the car together for 2.5 hours. He was explaining about Amandari on my way to Ubud as his home, as his village, not as a luxury hotel that people pay $2,000 per night for. So he was like, my village is like this, my neighbor is like this. And then I get to the hotel and the receptionist was his mother. And then the mother tells me that her father works in the kitchen. So I was like, what am I doing? Where am I staying? I just met three generations of a family who takes pride in their village. And the hotel is almost exactly mocking kind of the aesthetics of the village. And they all take pride in Amman and also the village that they grew up in. And I was like, why can't this happen in Japan, where I grew up or where I love and where my roots are from, and basically revitalize some of the beautiful neighborhoods that I love in Japan that are suffering from depopulation and less energy every year.
And Azumi, the property, it's absolutely beautiful, but it's interesting, you've done this fantastic renovation of this old house, but you haven't put a huge sign to announce to everyone it's there. It's so discreet. Was that always your intention, to keep it low-key?
Debatably. Adrian likes to keep it very discreet. I wish we could have gotten a little more information and press out there, but now every year we're becoming popular and popular, and we're getting guests staying, not only domestic guests but foreign guests. 60% of our guests are inbound tourists from abroad, and not only those guests, but we're also getting conversions of hotel guests becoming regulars at our Hotel Azumi or Yubune, the bathhouse, or Soil, which is kind of a more casual hotel. We have three on the island. And those regulars then eventually convert to doing business on the island, or actually moving there with family, or moving there and meeting someone and fostering a family. So if we've done the normal course of spreading out the word from day zero, it may have just created a boom, if you will, and we didn't. And then COVID came, which only allowed domestic people to come to the island. And I think those two events eventually kind of shaped what we do on the island, to really not just focus on putting the place onto the global map and inviting in guests from all around the world, but also to work with the locals, invite in domestic people, to create a broader community on a lot of people who actually care about this island, of how could they be involved, how can they proactively contribute to the community.
And I mean, was it always in the plan, you know, when you go to Azumi, you have Azumi on one side of the street, Yubune, which is the public bathhouse, anyone can use it. It also has rooms, slightly cheaper rooms, I have to say, than Azumi. Then you've got Soil, your other place. So you've kind of colonized the little town in the best possible way. And now you're even getting people moving into this wonderful little shopping street. And I've seen old photographs of it, and it was very vibrant, wasn't it, at one time?
Yes.
But now much quieter. So was there always this intention to do it, not by stealth exactly, but you were just taking over little bits, and in none of, it's not branded Azumi, or it's very, you know, it seems very organic.
That's right. So back to your first question of why that site, was that experience through Amandari, but also when we first got to the site, on top of spotting three people walking along the street, there were two shops open. One was the liquor shop. Another was a flower shop. I found that extremely sad, because if you come to think about it, those two businesses survive in an aging population community because people drink till the end. Well, many people do. And in Japan, there's a culture to buy beer or sake for the funeral, or when they go to your ancestors' graves, you basically gift flowers and alcohol. Well, it's part of the culture. So that's why those two were there. But when I entered the liquor shop, the grandpa who manages the liquor shop was so proud in showing me a picture from the 1950s. And it was unbelievable. Like right now, it's still a very tired, quiet, sleepy place, which I sort of like, but it was even quieter. But in the 1950s, it looked like one of the busiest places in the world. Like, there's so many people walking down the street, kids were smiling, and that's kind of what we saw.
Jutta Oker there in conversation with Fiona Wilson. And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. You can subscribe to the show on all good podcast platforms for new episodes every single week. And you can also subscribe to Monocle magazine for regular reports on design, architecture and urbanism. Just visit monocle.com. The Urbanist is produced by Carlotta Ribello and by David Stevens, who also edits this show. I'm Andrew Tuck. Goodbye, and thank you for listening, City Lovers.